May it please the court. ICI, by its affirmative act of releasing toxic asbestos into the environment outside its plant, became subject to a duty to all foreseeable victims of harm caused by its misfeasance. Here, the vehicle of transmission of the toxic asbestos to the Rydell home was the clothes of her husband, a totally innocent party. This form of transmission is no different legally than if the asbestos was improperly released into the environment by ICI and transmitted by the wind to the Rydell home, or was dumped into a stream on ICI's property and then flowed to the Rydell family well. The court below committed legal error when it ignored the distinction recognized in the Restatement of Torts 302A between a duty arising from a defendant's misfeasance and a duty when there is only nonfeasance. All of the Delaware cases relied on by the court below and ICI, which discuss the importance of relationships, all involve nonfeasance. I think 302, which this court cites in one of its landmark duty cases, Hercules Powder, the 1963 case, is especially critical here. And I would like to read a section of...
Did I hear you correctly? You say everything was nonfeasance by ICI?
All the cases cited by ICI in the court below were nonfeasance cases. And that's a very important distinction because ICI's actions here were misfeasance, were affirmative acts of misconduct.
The allegations within your complaint, are they misfeasance or nonfeasance?
They are misfeasance. We talk in terms of they're promoting the use of asbestos. They are carelessly using asbestos. They are releasing asbestos into the environment. One of the things in the Satterfield case that just came down yesterday in the Tennessee Supreme Court, I think did a very good job of discussing the difference between misfeasance and nonfeasance. And they said sometimes courts get confused because misfeasance starts a course of conduct and then there's some nonfeasance involved. And they cited the example of recklessly driving the car 20 miles over the speed limit and then failing to put your brakes. Now, somebody can say, oh, well, it's nonfeasance. You didn't put on your brakes. ICI didn't provide clothing. No, they set into motion. They were releasing the asbestos, and then they didn't put on their brakes to stop. And so it is clearly misfeasance throughout. The restatement says, in general, anyone who does an affirmative act is under a duty to others to exercise the care of a reasonable man to protect them from an unreasonable risk of harm to them arising out of the act. The duties to one who merely admits to do an act are more restricted and in general are confined to situations where there is a special relation. And 302 then refers to 314, which is a section that the court below talked extensively about. He went in order to find a relationship. Was there a special relationship? If we had a situation where you had a third party, say an insulation company, that had come onto ICI's property and they were carelessly using the asbestos and ICI didn't intervene, stop, to protect that release, then you would get into the special relationship because ICI is not doing the misfeasance. They are simply failing to intervene to protect someone. This we have a situation where ICI is the active duty. And part of the absurdity to say that there is no relationship is two situations. One, the court in oral argument started out saying it is well established that if ICI was releasing it into the environment, there would be a duty. And in fact, in Mrs. Rydell's case, she had no occupational exposure. She was a housewife almost the whole time, and she was a maid when she worked outside her home. But we had two theories of liability, household exposure and environmental exposure. She lived next to an asbestos manufacturing plant. Never any question in terms of havoc, and she's far more a stranger in terms of that plant, and she's a member of the Atlas family. The court below made it very clear. He assumed, recognized clear Delaware law for environmental discharge, you have the responsibility. And even further, defense counsel admitted to a court's question, well, what if ICI were a manufacturer? Would there be any duty? And she said yes. And that's interesting because ICI, as the court recognized, was a manufacturer of asbestos-containing products. And so if simply ICI had manufactured a product, sold it to a local hardware store, Mr. Rydell is working with that product in his construction business, gets the asbestos from ICI's product on his clothes, takes it home, and his wife washes the clothes, she has a case against ICI. Why? Because she's a manufacturer who has released it into the stream of commerce, and the only restriction is foreseeability. If there is a duty that a manufacturer has to everyone that it could conceivably hurt because of its affirmative misconduct, there certainly should be a duty to a member of the Atlas family. And that is a critical error that the court made below.
If Tennessee seems to have joined New Jersey. How did Georgia, Michigan, Maryland, and New York all come out the other way?
I think you have to make a distinction between some of the cases. Georgia is simply, I think, wrong. Although you can distinguish Georgia because it was a safe workplace doctrine. That's 343. They didn't do general negligence, the period of exposure. But I think in all candor, looking at Georgia, I think it's simply wrong. New York you can distinguish for two reasons. One, New York's jurisprudence is different than most other jurisdictions in terms of relationship is the only situation. But furthermore, if you look at the New York case, they are really focusing on the misconduct of the husband. I mean, the husband there, the Port Authority, which wasn't an asbestos manufacturer, they actually provided laundry facilities, uniforms. The carrier, the husband, refused to wear those. And so there was some comparative negligence. The case talks about that. Michigan, I think there are two things. One, Michigan says foreseeability is an aspect. They simply looked under the whole situation. It was exposure that was much earlier than was here. I think the facts that we have here in Michigan may have been different. Maryland, you actually have, interesting enough in terms of Maryland, all the asbestos cases that have gone to the Court of Appeals, they have basically upheld the right. You have the Doe case, which is an HIV case, and they did not uphold that. The Doe case, which is citing the Adams case, if you read the Adams case, it went to the jury on a general negligence theory. And the court said we could allow to do it. What the court said is we're not going to allow it to go on a special relationship 343 theory. And the plaintiff lost that case on general negligence. He simply could not prove the causation. So if I look at the Maryland jurisprudence, they allow this kind of case to go forward. The jurisdiction that clearly does not is Georgia, and it's really hard for me to distinguish that.
Mr. Crumpler, there are references in your brief to OSHA violations.
Yes.
What precisely is the relevance of that to your theories of liability? That is, are you claiming that there's negligence because there was a violation of OSHA, or does the OSHA violation have some other significance?
I think OSHA violation has two significances. This was not a theory that we're suing for a violation of OSHA. It goes to one, foreseeability. And many of the courts, the Texas courts, other courts have said, hey, it is certainly foreseeable to every single employer, even a small employer that's under OSHA in 1972, because OSHA is very specific. It says you have to have laundry facilities. In fact, if you send it outside to a independent third party, which in a sense ICI did because they knew their clothes had to be laundered, you have to warn it. So it goes to foreseeability. It also goes if this court feels that they have to have the relationship test and say on what basis, because duty really is, I think most of the courts say, it is a decision in terms of public policy. What under the social contract, what is fair in a civilized situation, and where do we see this policy? And I think OSHA clearly shows that policy. At the same time, EPA had it. The state of Delaware has an asbestos abatement. So there are plenty of body of law. So that's the significant. I think that we have exposure post-OSHA and pre-OSHA. I would submit, and I say this in my brief, that pre-OSHA it was very foreseeable, especially for a company as large as ICI and Atlas that actually knew some of this information before the general public did.
Was the Tennessee court correct on its analysis that there's no duty to warn?
I think in terms of that is, I would say I think there is a duty to warn, But if there is a question in terms of a limit, I mean, that basically deals with the specter of the bus driver and everything else. I can say, Your Honor, in the past 20 years of cases, there have never been, every single household exposure case has been a household, a family member. I think
Failure to warn is still part of your claim.
It still is, but I could survive with the Tennessee opinion because they say the breach was their negligence in terms of releasing it, and that simply is the most important part. I still think failure to warn is there, and especially failure to warn Mrs. Rydell. What the Tennessee court was trying to say is we can see a duty to immediate family members, but we're not going to impose a duty on Alcoa or ICI to warn the general world, the bus driver who picks up Mr. Rydell. So that's how they use the failure of warn as a way of limiting it. And I have no problem if this court would do that.
The way I understood your opening statement, it was that the duty extended to everyone who would come in contact with this clothing. There didn't seem to be any limitation on the rule you were advocating.
There is a limitation, and the limitation is foreseeability.
So under your rule, in this case, would there be a duty to the bus driver, as you're arguing the case, or not?
There would be a duty to the bus driver. I think that if a court had this case to a bus driver, I think I could see a court looking in terms of foreseeability and not allowing that to go to trial by simply saying under the facts and circumstances there, it is not at all foreseeable in terms of the bus driver being at risk. But that is still an open question. I mean, the test is once you affirmatively do something that causes harm, then the limitation on duty is foreseeability.
Well, I understand, and I'm trying to find out if you prevail in this case, the wife prevails.
Yes.
My question is, who else is foreseeable?
Well, I certainly think all family members are foreseeable, and that this court certainly could issue an opinion and say it's foreseeability, and say it is family members or people who regularly who are living in the household are they foreseeable. From a practical standpoint in terms of trials, why I would not do a bus driver case is because there is no medical evidence of that, no state-of-the-art information of that. With regard to family members, since 1897, there have been published reports of family members at risk in terms of this. So I think it is a red herring, but in terms of the rule, I think, and one of the things that we have to face here is I think this is the opportunity for this court to make very clear what the Delaware rule is on jurisprudence. I mean, if you look at all the cases, I think it's clearly that that's implicit. In most cases, you don't get to duty in terms of misfeasance because everyone's assumed it.
You're relating the duty to undertaking an affirmative act.
Yes, sir.
And then once you establish the duty, move to foreseeability.
Yes.
What are the limitations with regard to the duty when you undertake an affirmative act?
Well, the limitations in terms of you do an affirmative act, a negligent act, that is likely to cause harm. It is a question in terms of foreseeable victims. I mean, in fact, the amicus brief even talked in terms of if the asbestos clogged up, you know, her toilet and her toilet exploded. I mean, that's your kind of Paul's graph case, that even though they are negligent in terms of the release of it, the foreseeable harm or the actual harm was not foreseeable. And that would be a case where I think the court could easily enough say no duty in that situation. So
you think that's a question of law?
It is a mixed question of law and fact. I mean, foreseeability is an area where when you're defining duty, that the court deals with a general parameters of that. When you're dealing with, and that's the general, when you're dealing with the specific instance in the case, where it gets almost a proximate cause.
The difficulty with foreseeability being drawn by this court in this case for all time is reasonably obvious to me. What if, for example, the company did not know that Mr. Rydell was taking his work clothes to the laundry and someone working in a business laundry claimed to contract asbestosis from having to do his clothes over a period of years? The company, A, didn't know whether he was having his clothes done at home or not, or whether he was having them taken out. All they knew was they didn't provide either uniforms or cleaning services on the premises. How would we draw that kind of line in this case?
Well, one of two things. First of all, I think it's very clear. It's affirmative misconduct. It's foreseeability. And the court looks at the particular facts, and in a sense, creating a duty is almost a rough idea of justice. I think in terms of that particular case where you're dealing with laundering and the risk is from laundering clothes, anyone who is laundering the clothes. So I would say in that case, the laundromat, if you did that, would be a foreseeable victim. In fact, OSHA even says that almost a duty of the employer to find out who is doing it so they can warn that. So in that situation, I think foreseeability would be easy. In the case of the bus driver who picks them up every third Saturday, I think that is much more difficult. I can see in terms of the trial court, employing the test would simply say, and you have to get the facts of that, that is not foreseeable. This court cannot basically give an opinion in every single conceivable instance. But the court can articulate really what is the test, and the test is when it's affirmative misconduct, you have created a relationship by your misconduct with the victim. You are responsible. The limitations is to foreseeability. How that plays out, I really don't think it's that difficult in terms of foreseeable victims. It's almost kind of like when you see it, I think a judge can recognize that this is a foreseeable or non-foreseeable. I think the laundromat, when you're dealing with the risk from laundering asbestos-laden clothes, is very definitely a foreseeable victim.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I do. The last thing I just might want to say, but this court, even though I don't think is necessary, but if they feel that they have to have a limitation, they can certainly have, in this particular case, the limitation to immediate members of the household. We certainly have that with the Atlas family. But thank you. I will save the balance of my time.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Krista Samus on behalf of Appellee ICI Americas, Inc. ICI has two roles in this case, that of landowner and that of employer. Plaintiff is unable to find a duty between ICI and the plaintiff as a landowner or as an employer, and therefore seeks to create a cause of action that's unprecedented under Delaware law.
Well, isn't there a third role, and that's a manufacturer?
No, Your Honor. ICI was not sued as a manufacturer of asbestos-containing products. There's no evidence that appellant was exposed to any products manufactured by ICI containing asbestos or that any asbestos-containing products were manufactured at this site. Appellant's contention that whether or not there's misfeasance or nonfeasance creates a difference in the court's duty analysis is incorrect. Delaware law has never recognized a difference between the duty analysis in either a misfeasance or nonfeasance case. Further, there's problems with analyzing duty under a misfeasance or nonfeasance standard.
Do you understand the opinion of the Superior Court to hold that before there can be any duty as between a defendant and a plaintiff, there has to be a cognizable relationship of some kind?
Yes.
And that's also ICI's position?
Yes.
How do you account, therefore, for cases where a duty has been held to exist and there is no prior relationship? Two cars passing each other on a highway, and one veers into the lane of the other car.
Your Honor, the court's the car's spatial and temporal proximity is what creates a duty in that situation. When we look at a legally significant relationship,
but there's no legally significant relationship, before the crash. There's no cognizable relationship, no traditional category that those two strangers fit into.
Well, actually, that legally significant relationship comes from the fact that they aren't spatial and temporal proximity. As Judge Sleitz held in Kaczynski, where there were the two motorboat operators, it was their spatial and temporal proximity that created the legally significant relationship. All of this court's cases, Marshall, Ignato, Furyk, all focus on the legally significant relationship, which is a prerequisite to the imposition of a duty.
But wasn't Judge Sleitz really saying there has to be some legally recognized relationship between the alleged tortfeasor and the plaintiff before a duty can be said to arise? And that because there was no legally cognizable or recognized relationship between the employer or landlord here and the wife of the employee, ergo, no duty.
That's correct.
And do you subscribe, that is, does your client subscribe to and advocate that paradigm as the way that this court should be analyzing the issue of whether there is a duty for purposes of a negligence cause of action?
Yes. In a negligence cause of action, in order for a duty to be imposed, there must be some legally recognizable, significant relationship between the two parties.
Then if that is the case, again, I ask you, how do you account for the multiplicity of cases where duties have been held to exist between two parties who were strangers up until the moment of the accident?
A legally recognizable relationship does not require that the parties actually know each other. It's that there's a number of ways to find the relationship, one being through common law and statute. And under common law, it's recognized that parties in proximity to each other who share a spatial and temporal relationship do have a relationship, even though they are strangers to one another.
As I understand your point, when you're driving a car, you have a duty to other motorists on the roadway and pedestrians. And it's that the nature of that relationship created at the point in time when you're on the roadway with other motorists or going through an intersection with pedestrians, that the duty arises to conduct yourself in a way that your negligence doesn't injure the other motorist or the pedestrian.
That's correct, because at that point in time, you're in the same space together, creating that relationship.
Well, there's at least an argument that one can glean from the appellant's briefs that the relationship here was one that was trumpeted by the employer, that is, that they're all one big happy family, which would include members of the household of their workers. And if their workers were allowed to go home with asbestos on their work clothes, that was all part of the family relationship. It wasn't, as we've just heard, the bus driver who picks him up 3 days during the week. It wasn't even the employee of a dry cleaner where he took his clothes, but that the employer touted this family relationship. Does that not mean there's the legal duty that would be foreseeable from touting that relationship?
The simple fact that a newsletter is placed, is given to an employee by the employer does not create a legally significant or recognizable relationship to impose a duty in this scenario. Further, when it comes to that, the reliance on the newsletter is just an extension of plaintiff's foreseeability argument. And Delaware law has never imposed a duty based on foreseeability alone.
Could I ask you, doesn't the restatement make a distinction between nonfeasance and misfeasance for purposes of whether there has to be a relationship?
Yes, it does, but the Delaware courts have never recognized a distinction between the two. And to recognize a distinction between...
But wait a second. So you're saying that the Delaware courts don't follow the restatement in tort law?
No. That's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. I'm saying that the problem with looking at a misfeasance versus nonfeasance argument is that either side can plead, can twist the facts in a way that come out as misfeasance or nonfeasance. Further, appellant has not pled misfeasance in his complaint, in her complaint. As a matter of fact, if you look at the complaint, the allegations against Havoc are environmental allegations, whereas the allegations against ICI are household exposure. So appellant has not even pled misfeasance in this case.
Well, they said that they did. They're mistaken?
Yes, because they've pled the household exposure.
The issue in the Tennessee Supreme Court decision that Judge Koch decided, it was a motion to dismiss similar allegations, and he said that the complaint should survive a motion to dismiss.
But at this point, we're much further along, and we have facts. This is a summary. Judge Slight's opinion is the result of a summary judgment motion.
Well, one of the facts is that on the employees, on Mr. Riddell's work premises, there were no laundry facilities, and he wasn't required to wear uniforms. It would be turned in at the end of the day, change into his ordinary work clothes that would not be, if it's the correct word, contaminated by asbestos, and would go home with clean clothing. Is the failure to provide that alternative not a claim of malfeasance?
No, Your Honor. That would be, it's ICI's position that's a claim of nonfeasance and a failure to act and failure to warn. However, beyond that, whether or not there were any facilities provided goes to the issue of breach and not to the issue of whether or not there's a duty in this case. Because in order for a duty to be imposed, is recognized under Delaware law and is recognized by this court in Marshall, in Ignacio, in Furick, in Nadu, a legally significant relationship is necessary.
How do we distinguish this case, say, from a large toxic emission from a factory that rolls across a community or an entire state and does harm to people? With the argument that there must be a relationship preclude liability in that?
Well, in that situation, Your Honor, the relationship would be a result of the fact that they're neighbors with the defendant landowner. In this case, Mrs. Riddell, far removed from ICI's facility at the time of the alleged exposure, has no relationship with ICI whatsoever.
So it's a distance correlation?
No, it's whether or not there's a legally recognized relationship. When you're talking about toxic emissions into the environment, you're looking at the landowner's relationship with its neighbors and in that situation. In this situation, there's no connection, no pre-existing relationship between appellant and ICI.
Well, she's married to a worker who's allowed to leave the plant with asbestos on his clothes, when the simple alternative would be to provide a place to either wash those clothes and have clean ones in a locker, or providing with uniforms, which he was required to leave at the door before he left. What's the difference in him walking out with asbestos on his clothes and pollution coming from a smokestack that gets into the community?
Again, the difference is in the pre-existing relationships between the parties and the fact that...
Well, in the case of pollution coming from the smokestack, there is no pre-existing relationship between anyone who's harmed and the emission of the pollutant. Here, you have a worker who the company knows is married, who they allow to go home with painted clothing, and someone in his home, the person in this case just happens to be somebody to whom he's married, contracts a disease that's related to that transfer of that asbestosis to the household. How is that not a relationship?
ICI and appellant had no relationship. The only connection between ICI and appellant was through Mr. Riddell's, appellant's spouse's, employment with ICI. the connection between Mrs. Rydell and ICI is too attenuated to impose a duty or recognize as legally significant.
Well, when Judge Taylor met the same set of facts in the late 1980s, though the argument was put to him in terms of privity, he found it was just a regular, ordinary act of negligence that caused harm to someone that was in the zone of danger. How do you distinguish that case?
I believe Your Honor's referring to the Shoebrooks opinion. Mm-hmm. In that case, the court did not decide whether or not there was a legally significant relationship. Rather, what the Superior Court held was that privity was not required for either a contractual claim on, I apologize, for a claim for breach of contract or breach of warranty or a tort claim. However, there was no holding as to whether or not there was a legally significant relationship in a household exposure claim.
Let's try one slight variation on the hypothetical that was posed to you by the Chief Justice and by Justice Ridgely. Instead of having an environmental, describing this as an environmental case where you have something toxic coming out of a smokestack, suppose ICI was manufacturing a drug, and as part of the manufacturing process, there was a chemical that was toxic that went into the making of the drug. And certain employees were exposed to that toxic chemical, and the nature of the toxic chemical was that that if it got on the employee's person or clothes, that when the employee came into contact with anyone else, that also would expose the person with whom the employee came into contact. And ICI didn't tell the employee about that danger. Employee goes home, has physical contact with his wife or with his children. Becomes ill, and so does the family member. How does this case differ from that?
Your Honor, it's actually very similar, and in that case, there would be no duty because there's no legally recognizable relationship. What plaintiff seeks is to focus the duty analysis on foreseeability alone, and there are three problems with that. One, Delaware law has never recognized that foreseeability alone is the sole determinant of a duty. However, it also turns... The second problem is that arguing that foreseeability alone can create a duty turns the duty analysis on its head. Traditionally, and as this court is aware, it is the court's role to determine whether or not there's a duty.
Let's try a different example. Let's suppose the company is involved with anthrax, which is very dangerous. And the employee leaves, and anybody outside, gets exposed to anthrax. Are you saying that because there was no relationship between the people outside the building, there was no duty to prevent employees from leaving with anthrax on their clothing?
Your Honors, I understand your hypothetical. Would the anthrax be carried on the clothing, or would it be something that was... Yes, in that case, there is no legally significant relationship as required by Delaware law. And to base the duty on foreseeability alone raises a number of issues, not only the fact that it's never been recognized before, but the fact that, duty now becomes a tribal issue of fact because duty is a fact-intensive inquiry that's reserved for the jury.
Well, then how is anyone ever held liable, going back to the smokestack example? If you release something into the air that makes everyone outside the plant sick, are you saying there's no cause of action because you had no prior relationship?
No, there is a cause of action in that situation. The relationship that is established is that of neighbors. The landowners is neighbors with the community in that situation.
But what if it blows into the adjoining state? There would be no cause of action there because there's no neighborhood analogy?
In that context, those individuals would still be viewed as neighbors because of the proximity to the...
The parameters of the pollution would encompass the neighborhood, wouldn't it? Wherever it reached would be considered the neighborhood.
But that's completely different than, in this case, Mr. Rydell leaving ICI's premises, going down to his home far removed from ICI's property. This isn't, it's a different factual scenario as recognized by the New York courts in Holdem. And it's recognized by the plaintiff in his pleadings.
For me to understand your earlier comment about duty becoming a factual determination, let me make sure I understand that, because I think generally we know duty is not a factual determination. Mm-hmm. It's determined by the court. It's a matter of law. But what I heard you say, I think, was that if we were to turn the concept of duty on its head and make duty turn entirely on foreseeability, as appellant requests here, then we would be transforming a legal ruling into a factual one because foreseeability is so intensely factual. Is that your point?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the other problem with relying on foreseeability, the third problem, is, as this court recognized earlier, the fact that it would create limitless liability. There'd be no line to draw. It would, and a landowner would now owe a duty to anyone who comes into contact with anyone, not just an employee, but anyone who sets foot on that employee's premises.
So the way of construing that is to say we would be imposing strict liability.
Yes. Yes. And it would be impractical and economically unfeasible to warn the community at large of any potential dangers.
Well, what about appellant's point is we can avoid that danger here in Delaware by the five of us constituting this court crafting a rule of law that logically and reasonably restricts the scope of foreseeability. So the little chamber of horrors that you've just painted wouldn't exist at all if we crafted it carefully enough, even if we did no more than limit it to the facts of this case, where it was a household member of an employee.
At a certain point, if the court were to craft a narrow line, it would be impossible to fairly craft that line. For instance, what if there's a babysitter in the home who's there more often than the employee's spouse and maybe does the laundry? Now, it would be impossible to limit the duty and to just the immediate family members or the spouse, because there are so many other foreseeable, or what plaintiff would argue are foreseeable plaintiffs in this case, in these situations, and that it would extend beyond the household members.
Well, doesn't that get us back to the misfeasance versus nonfeasance issue? Because if you have to have, as I understand the restatement at least, if it's nonfeasance, then there has to be a relationship in order for there to be a duty. But if it's misfeasance, then there does not need to be any relationship between the wrongdoer and the victim. All there has to be is foreseeability, which still would limit the range of potential claimants to those people who it would be foreseeable could be harmed by whatever the misfeasance was. Why is that not a workable rule of law, which I believe is what the restatement says the law is?
Again, it would create a limitless class of plaintiffs, an indeterminate class of plaintiffs. The plaintiffs would argue bus drivers, the bus driver who's driving the bus that the employee rode home is foreseeable. The spouse of the Federal Express employee who delivers a package at the landowner's property would become foreseeable.
Well wait a second. The person has to have been injured also. Right? I mean, otherwise we've got no claims here.
Well, so, that's correct, Ron.
Okay, so if what your client is putting on the appellant's husband's clothing is so toxic that even the process of getting on a bus to go home releases some of this toxic material and causes an illness in the bus driver, then that has to be pretty potent stuff. And arguably the person who is, or the company that's responsible for allowing this toxic material out of the workplace should be responsible for the results of it. That it would be foreseeable that, as the anthrax example, because my understanding is anthrax, all you have to do is come in contact with it for a moment and you can suffer injury. So why shouldn't it be foreseeable that with such a toxic material, the party responsible for releasing it has to face liability for it?
Delaware law has never recognized duty based on foreseeability alone. The duty analysis is a twofold analysis that first requires a legally significant relationship be found. To find that duty would be based on foreseeability is a complete deviation from Delaware jurisprudence.
Are you saying that Delaware's rejected the restatement or that Delaware's never directly addressed this issue in the restatement?
It's never been directly addressed, but all the cases that address duty have required a legally significant relationship.
Well, and Mr. Crumpler's telling us that all of those are nonfeasance cases. Do you know of a Delaware misfeasance case that would support your argument today from Delaware?
The cases that appellant cites as nonfeasance cases, one being the Burroughs case. It's a case where there were uninsulated power lines. That would actually be affirmative misfeasance in placing uninsulated power lines out in the community. It turns to the whole problem of the standard between misfeasance and nonfeasance would be so difficult to draw because any fact pattern can be argued either way. I see I'm running out of time. In summary, ICI in this case is a landowner and an employer. A landowner's relationships have been defined under years of Delaware jurisprudence as having a duty with invitees, licensees, trespassers, and neighbors. And landowner is never held or owed a duty to someone far removed from its property. As an employer, ICI did not owe a duty to appellant because appellant was not an employee of ICI, and the duty to provide a safe workplace has never, under Delaware law, been extended beyond that, has never been extended beyond the employee. Therefore, ICI respectfully requests this court affirm the lower court's decision.
Thank you.
In her remarks,
one quick question. The restatement section on which you relied that distinguishes between misfeasance and malfeasance is what? What number is that?
It's 302A. 302 is the restatement, and it's comment A that I read. I would note that the Tennessee court, there's a restatement 3, and in the Satterfield decision, they discuss that, and they say that it goes even further. I only dealt with restatement 2. With regard to Justice Berger's question about Delaware not following the restatement, Delaware certainly does, and in fact, Judge Sleights, one of the bases is he specifically made a big deal that he pointed to the restatement. The problem is he skipped 302. I mean, he went directly to 314, and the restatement at 302 says if it's total nonfeasance, yes, you go to 314. But if it's misfeasance, you don't need to get there. And with the question as to whether I pled it, A57, and I quote, her husband's employer controlled the safety and working conditions and or promoted the use of asbestos. The spouse employer defendants are ICI Americas. And in our reply, in our brief, we talked in terms of the court even recognizes there are different theories, and in fact we have to designate and says you've got manufacturers, you've got landowner theories, and you've got household theories. And standing order in terms of simply setting out, and I submit that's because it's well recognized, for the past 20 years, there have been over 150
household exposure cases. They only represent about 5% of the docket. They've gone to trial. They've been affirmed by this Supreme Court. Now, I would agree even in the Wilson case that issue was not raised, but I think it shows a little bit in terms of what is the understanding of the entire Delaware bar and the judiciary. It is, even though there has never been a decision, and I hopefully this will be the decision that makes it very clear in terms of misfeasance and nonfeasance, but when you have misfeasance, it's never really an issue because everybody assumes what is clear law is there is a duty, and that's what the restatement does. That's what Shoebrooks did. Shoebrooks was a case where they moved for summary judgment, and they said no duty, and the court said, yes, there was a duty. And now they raised privity, saying there was no direct relationship. He said, we don't have to worry about that. And what did Judge Taylor cite? He cited Dr. Castleman's book in terms of the foreseeability. Very kind of clearly, hey, there's a duty here, and this is not so unforeseen.
So how do you read the Tennessee case, which, as I understand it, was an appeal on a motion to dismiss? In reversing the grant of the motion, what are the implications?
The implications of Tennessee simply goes with, I think, the majority, goes with the restatement, and goes with Delaware jurisprudence that when you have misfeasance, there is a duty. That duty is limited by foreseeability, and it's not that difficult. I mean, any court, when they come up with duty, looks at the facts. This court looked at the facts and said the relationship was too attenuated. I mean, he was looking at the facts and coming up with a legal duty.
Tennessee basically held, you stated a cause of action.
Yes, and that's what we want this court to do, that we have stated a cause of action. And it's a cause of action that Shoebrooks said was stated. It's a cause of action, I think, this court in the Mergenthaler case, which was up on a motion to dismiss, they implicitly said, they said, it looks like you have a cause of action, but you have no proof of contact. And so they reversed the case in terms of that particular thing.
Can you help me understand that, can there ever be a nonfeasance circumstance involving a manufacturer or someone like ICI? Or is it the fact that you open the doors for business, that's enough of an affirmative act that everything is misfeasance?
No, absolutely there can be nonfeasance. I mean, for somebody such as ICI. I mean, for an employer, when you are putting something in the stream of commerce, a dangerous material, that is a misfeasance. Maybe nonfeasance, they should have done something extra, and there could be a question in terms of special duty. This is not a landowner case. The landowner cases, which I think is something, again, the court in Tennessee said a lot of people get confused about it, and I think Judge Slights got confused about it. ICI even said it's a landowner case to your honors, and they said that. It's not a landowner case. Landowners, very clearly in terms of Helm, you have an independent third party that causes a harm, and it's your nonfeasance in taking steps to protect. And that is, and that's a question where the court's gone in terms of the duty to certain business invitees. That's the whole kind of question where we look in terms of the University of Delaware cases. It's all a third party that is causing the harm. And with regard to affirmative misconduct, I mean, we look in terms of all the cases where someone steals somebody else's car. I mean, he's not even on the road, but it is what the decisions have come out where you leave the ignition in the keys, you've done an affirmative act. When the keys are simply under the park bench and somebody finds it, that's not your affirmative act. So this court and the Superior Court is perfectly capable of dealing with things. With regard to the relationship, I mean, there clearly was. I mean, if we have to come down to saying that you have to have a relationship, and I think that shows really the absurdity of that test. I mean, and Judge Slights even said it can be outcome determinative. To say there is no relationship here, and the back and forth in terms of environmental, I mean, it's a discharge. And it's simply a difference between the wind and the back. And, in fact, ICI here wanted to promote a relationship. And I have in my brief an attachment, the point where, sure enough, they developed morale, and she sent her son. I mean, that's the a company benefits by trying to say there is this family relationship. And certainly if this court feels they have to deal with relationship, I think as a matter of public policy, that when we say to the public that you're safe from environmental pollution if it's carried by the wind, but you're not safe from pollution which is inadvertently carried by employees who are innocent victims of anthrax, radioactivity, or anything of that kind, I think is simply absurd.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.